Hello, and welcome to the Hawthorne Hotel. My name's Brian Green, and we're here with the campaign against the EU Constitution tonight. And we were to have a debate, and due to the fact that we couldn't find someone who would debate with us, we have two speakers who will be arguing from the for no to Lisbon. We did ask James O'Reilly TD from Fine Gael, Darragh O'Brien TD from Fianna Fáil, and Trevor Sargent, and we also told them we would shift the day if a date didn't suit them, but they were unable to debate with us here on any date that we tried for. So we are very delighted that Claire Daly and Patricia McKenna can be here this evening to speak. Claire will speak first for about 15 minutes on aspects of workers' rights and public services and privatisation vis-a-vis the Lisbon Treaty. And following that, Patricia McKenna will speak about militarism and everything else that Claire hasn't covered that she'd like to discuss tonight with regards to the campaign against the EU Constitution. Then we'll open it up to the floor, and then we'll take it back to each of the two speakers in, I think, reverse order the way that they went out, and they'll sum up, and that will be that. But if you don't bolt for the door just at the end, we may ask you to take some leaflets from us to distribute wherever you can. So what I'm going to do is just ask you to sound down your mobiles or power them down for the meeting, and take note of the fire escapes, which is behind me and through the door you came in. So in case the fireworks are up here tonight, it's out the door you came in. We'll go over to Councillor Claire Daly of the Socialist Party to kick off tonight's non-debate.
Right, thanks, Brian. I think we can be fairly informal. I'd stand up because I know from experience this room can get very hot, so it's better to stand up and keep on my toes. I think Brian was very polite when he said that the other parties were unable to debate with us. The reality is that they've displayed a cowardice in meeting head-on the arguments around this issue. They're quite prepared to spend millions and glossy advertisements and posters and all the rest of it, but when they're offered the opportunity to debate the issues face to face, they were unwilling to do so. And I think that in some ways more than a lot says a lot about their campaign. I got a leaflet this morning in the door from Punchius de Rossa on the Yes side, where he makes the point, madly in my opinion, but that more than any previous treaty, this is the one which advances the rights of citizens and progresses the social agenda in Europe. Now, I think that's quite unfortunate from de Rossa's point of view, because in actual fact, the opposite is the case, that more than any other treaty that we have had, this prioritises big business interests over the social rights and the rights of people. And I think even if you didn't read the details of the treaty, you only have to look at those who are lined up to support it to kind of guess where they're coming from. Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, the PDs, IBEC itself. Every single newspaper now, far from balanced coverage, you nearly have an 80-90% of a yes opinion coming across in the multimillionaire-owned media. And these people, of course, never stand up for workers or have the interests of ordinary people. So why would it be any different in terms of this campaign? Why are they spending so much money? Is it that they're really that concerned about the interests of ordinary people? Clearly not. I think one of the most ironic things about it is the way in which they refer to that this treaty is going to advance the cause of democracy in Europe. A treaty that's to improve democracy that absolutely nobody has a say in whatsoever except people in Ireland, and that was only because a citizen took a case against the government and forced, if you like, a referendum on all of these issues. Everybody else is excluded from that, and in actual fact the countries which have voted already, because this is simply a rehash of the EU constitution. In France and the Netherlands have already rejected many of the proposals. So there are a huge number of aspects to this, and we kind of try to divide them, and I'm really been asked to deal with two particular issues, but even if we don't, between us, cover all the points, we felt it was a bit better to spend a little bit of time on one or two of the points and then leave it open. We can take questions from the floor in terms of other aspects to that. The first thing that I want to deal with really is that the fact that the treaty increases the drive to privatisation of public services in general, but specifically in areas that were previously protected by a veto, particularly the areas of health, education and social services. Now, the smart Alex in the Yes campaign would say this is a nonsense. Read the treaty. Never once does it mention privatisation anywhere. And technically speaking, that is correct. They don't use the word privatisation, but other words are used that mean the exact same thing. Liberalisation, the free market, competition, all of these are enshrined as the cornerstones of the EU. And that really, if you like, the agenda being pushed by most of the governments in Europe is a neoliberal agenda in any way, and this treaty extends that process. And that has very, very serious consequences for workers and society in general. And I want to maybe use an example of the most recent privatisation that has taken place in Ireland, which will be the one which had an impact here in this area, the privatisation of Aer Lingus. And just very briefly, if you look at that situation, here you had a company 70 years old, set up by the state to provide employment, but crucially to have a strategic interest as an island nation, linking us up with Europe and America and so on. 6 years ago even, there were 7,500 people employed in that company, tens of thousands of people employed in its history, providing a good service and a link opening up the west of Ireland, strategic development. Two times did they get money from the state, and on numerous occasions those monies were repaid more and more times again. We used to make the point that in the 1980s the amount of taxation revenue generated from Aer Lingus workers on their own was more than all of the farmers in the country at that time. So to us, such a company made sound economic sense. That is a good economic strategy. Companies which provide employment, give a good service and so on. But that, of course, is not the ideology that dominates in Europe today or dominates the Irish government. And if you like, the consequences in that company in the run-up to privatisation were that thousands of jobs were shed. I won't bore you with the details, but the service was axed, a lot of functions were outsourced, and the victims of that were the consumer and the workers. We saw it in Shannon with the routes to London axed by that company, and the west of Ireland being denied a crucial link to Heathrow. Government just shook its hand. Sorry about that. Yeah, that is bad, but nothing we can do about it. It's a private company. Again, the consequences on the workers there, pay being withheld while the tops of that company get record pay rises. Now, one of the key arguments used by the government to bolster its ability to privatise Aer Lingus was the EU. Competition, we're not allowed to invest. Sorry about that, but the EU was holding us back. And that was a common argument put forward in the newspapers and amongst the politicians to muddy the waters, really, around this issue. Because, of course, it is possible, even under EU law, to invest in profitable companies. There's absolutely nothing to stop a government in doing that. But even though that's the reality, it didn't stop that argument being used to fudge the issue. And of course, we would say back as well, even if a company isn't profitable, there's still a significant basis for a government to invest in it if it's providing employment, an important social service and so on. Why should that not be a sound economic goal? Of course it should. And the reality is that the EU really has been in some ways a convenient shield for the government to do what they would have wanted to do in any way. It's a little bit like, say, at a local level, you take the issue of waste management, where there was huge problems in them being able to site dumps in certain locations, because obviously the local communities would put pressure on the councillors. The councillors then would look to alternative methods of waste management. But instead of doing that, what they did was they took the power away from the councillors, gave it to an unelected county manager, and then the councillors could say, oh yeah, we're on the side of the community, we don't want to dump there, but sorry about that, there's nothing we can do about it. And it's a little bit like that at government level. The national government abdicates its responsibility and says, sorry about that, it's Europe, it's nothing got to do with us. But we are quite clear that this is a government of big business, which itself is firmly wedded to the neoliberal agenda, which is really all about undermining workers' rights and public services in order to drive private profit for the owners of the multinational corporations. That's what all of the treaties have been about, and this one goes even further. An open market with free competition. And there has been sustained propaganda around these ideas. They talk about competition, but what they really mean is undermining public services to allow the private sector cream off the best bits. And that's not good for society, and it's not good for workers. The only section of society that benefits is the private owners of those companies. And there's a very good example of that here in Swords, where you have the 41X bus service operated by Dublin Bus, who the Department of Transport have refused to allow use the port tunnel, provided for by taxpayers on the grounds that it's competing with a private bus company and so on. But I mean, and it would be unfair for a subsidised state company to compete with a private firm. And they say that if they allow them to do that, the private company would take action against them. That's absolutely ludicrous way of looking at something, when everybody agrees that the best way forward for everybody is to get as many people as possible onto public transport, reduce the amount of emissions. Even from an environmental point of view, it's absolutely laughable. But in reality, what this is about is undermining the public service to allow the private operators have exclusive use of the tunnel and benefit themselves instead. But Lisbon really extends this whole issue of competition and privatisation by declaring and enshrining the primacy of the market. And I think we did see a glimpse of how this is going to pan out with the very controversial issue of the water charges in schools, which put a hefty bill on all of the schools. They all shrugged their arms and wrung their hands. Oh, this is terrible that the schools are... But again, it wasn't us, it was Europe. And that type of scenario is precisely what could be opened up in the fields of health and education by the Lisbon Treaty. And if people don't have to take our word for that, when we have the very word of IBEC, the employers' organisations themselves, where they spell out and say, the Lisbon Treaty Reform Treaty creates the legal basis for the liberalisation of services of general economic interest. A yes vote for the Lisbon Treaty creates the potential for increased opportunities for Irish business, particularly in areas subject to increasing liberalisation, such as health, education, transport, energy and the environment. So in other words, absolutely nothing is sacred. Everything can be treated as a commodity and everything is up for grabs. This treaty is enshrining a significant change in the way in which the EU proposes to deal with trading in public services. Now, I'm not going to bore people with the nuances, but the particular article that enshrines this is Article 188, which in essence means that we lose the veto to stop the mandatory opening up of these services. That's something that exists. Nobody can touch these services now because any national government can veto it. Under the treaty, that veto is lost. Again, I won't bore you with it, but it talks about Article 188, talks about the achievement of uniformity in the measures of liberalisation, and talks about the Commission shall make recommendations to the Council which shall authorise it to open up the necessary negotiations. The negotiations and conclusion of the agreement shall be by qualified majority. So it's absolutely, there's no ambiguity in this whatsoever. It is quite clear. And you know, ordinary people can't have any confidence in terms of the EU Commission in dealing with trade negotiations with bodies such as the World Trade Organization. The Commission itself is dominated by pro-neoliberal, pro-privatisation agenda. There is a little caveat that the qualified majority doesn't apply where, as they quote, these agreements risk seriously disturbing the national organisation of such services and prejudicing the responsibility of member states to deliver them. Now, if anybody can tell me what that means in English, I'll give them a fiver or more. They, you know, let's face it, the EU Commission doesn't have any problem with privatisation, doesn't have any problem with the way in which the two-tier nature of the Irish health service now. So the fact that access is denied to loads of people in the health service, that wouldn't be a particular problem for them to any great extent. But I mean, we can open up maybe that point a little bit later. I'm conscious of maybe going on a little bit, but I do think that this is one of the key areas that needs to be brought out into the domain. Well, somebody said to me before the meeting started that there's a quote in one of the local papers from Fine Gael, who have a meeting on this issue tonight, saying that some politicians in this area, i.e. me obviously, are claiming that that our claims on privatisation are false. But while they can say that in a press statement to North County Leader, they didn't feel big enough and bold enough to come along and say it tonight in this forum here. But I think what's been talked about and what's unfolding really is the chaos of the market getting predominance on all aspects of our society, even the ones which the limited protection that's there now would be gone with the adoption of Lisbon. Now, there are many more articles inside the treaty which talk about things like state aid being limited, where it distorts or threatens to distort competition. It restricts state spending in public services. So in other words, what you could have, and it's not in any way scaremongering, but I don't know if people read the stuff in the papers, in some of the papers over the weekend, about Dublin City Council and the local authorities putting in their submission to the Commission on Taxation, where they're calling for the reintroduction of water charges, recycling charges, increased motor tax charges for people who live in Dublin, an amenity charge and about seven or eight other charges. And this, if you like, against the backdrop of a tightening of state expenditure, would be the way in which governments would see a way out. So really what we're saying is the treaty means that the freedom to buy companies, to move capital and to maximise profits is the priority. That is no ambiguity about that. And then issues like employment, control of protection and the environment take very much second place. And against the backdrop where you already have a million, oh, well over a million and a half people in EU areas living below the average unemployment rates. You've seen the whole-scale deindustrialisation of parts of Eastern Europe. What you can see being created for the multinationals is a pool of cheap labour that can be exploited by either coming over to Ireland or other countries to be exploited in that manner, or for the multinationals to go and site itself in those countries and exploit away there. And what you have is, rather than this idea of, oh, a rising tide lifts all boats, you have the rising tide sinking everybody, really, because what Lisbon does is it opens a legal door for cheap labour to undermine pay and conditions that have been fought for by the union movements for decades, and accelerates the race to the bottom. Now, I'll let people maybe come in on that in the debate, but just briefly, because I'm already at my time, some of the organisations who are supporting this treaty, who would be not of the virulent right-wing employers' organisations, the likes of the Labour Party or some of the trade union leaders, although it's interesting that even the numbers of trade unions that are supporting this are getting smaller as we get nearer to the deadline. But one of the reasons that they give for justifying their support for the treaty is that it enshrines the Charter of Fundamental Rights. But we would like to say very clearly that that statement is making a claim to offer a level of protection for workers which simply does not exist inside this treaty. I think it's very unfortunate for De Rossa in his leaflet today that one of the things he highlights as a right is the right to collective bargaining and action to defend yourself, including the right to strike action, when it was precisely this issue which gave rise to SIPTU coming out. And let's face it, SIPTU would not be known for being particularly radical, but as a result of the lack of security and protection on that precise point, SIPTU came out over the weekend and said they could not recommend a yes vote, because while there is a recognition that the right of workers to collective bargaining is there, That right is not fundamental. It's only in accordance with community and national law. It's not an absolute right, and Cowan made it abundantly clear that the government were not willing to legislate for that. And if you like, the points that some people have drawn is that it's very like all the assurances given on Nice, a lot of platitudes but nothing concrete, and therefore many of the issues like the exploitation of agency workers are still there today and nothing concrete has been given. Very clear that workers' rights are secondary to the right to free and unfettered competition. And all of these rights, some of them are quite woolly and vague. They're who will determine or interpret what those rights will be? Again, it's the European Court of Justice, and they have already have precedent on this, so we're not even going to guess what this court is going to say about those rights. And again, just very briefly, the cases have been well aired, but in December of last year, they declared that the Swedish trade unions were in breach of EU law by picketing the Latvian company Laval for paying below the industrial rate. So, if you like, the unions were ruled to be taking unlawful action. And the court said that the only legally enforceable wage rate was the minimum wage in that country, that all of the extra agreements that the unions had negotiated, the rate of pay in that instance for the job was €16 an hour, but the minimum wage was €9 an hour. But legally, the European Court of Justice said they could only claim the €9. So in other words, the minimum wage in country is becoming the maximum wage. And every trade union agreement that the unions have fought for and workers have sacrificed, nearly, you might as well rip it up and throw it out the door if you think that the EU is going to protect your claim for them. Absolutely not. We had the other example there recently, just last month, the Ruford case. Again, where the court ruled that a Polish subcontractor who had been operating in Lower Saxony in Germany could pay workers there less than half the agreed construction rate of pay in that state. So that's the direction in which they are going. The response by the European Trade Union Federation to that was, in effect, this is an open invitation for social dumping, which will not only threaten workers' rights and working conditions, but also the capacity of local, small and medium enterprises to compete on a level playing field with foreign subcontractors. It does not recognise the rights of trade unions to demand equal wages and working conditions and the observance of collective agreed standards applying to the place of work for migrant workers. So in other words, it's a licence to exploit people. Now, already we can see, and not just in Ireland but in other countries, closure of factories, relocation on a regular basis, or anybody in any job will have the argument of competition and the need to compete thrown against you in order to keep workers' rights down. The only alternative to that agenda is for workers to unite across international boundaries. And the first step, we would say, is a rejection of the treaty. We've seen the constitution rejected in France and in the Netherlands, which is why they'd be afraid to put it there again. And again, there's some very good campaigns by unions in other countries against it. We fully support the fight for workers' rights internationally, not just in the EU itself, but across all of Europe and beyond Europe itself, because the interests of workers everywhere, we have much more in common than the employers. And I think, you know, a key part of our stance is a defence of public services and decent pay and conditions for workers everywhere. Very much this is about a Europe which puts people before profit, which puts the rights and interests of workers ahead of the unfettered competition of the market, and where the wealth is used for the benefit of, as we would say, the millions rather than the millionaires who are currently creaming it off.
Thank you, Claire. Before our next speaker, I'd like to apologise for being able to see the sunshine, because I can't block it out with any blinds because they don't exist. I thought Swords was so built up you wouldn't see the sunset, but you can see it tonight. We're going to hand out our attendance sheet during our next speaker, and I'll hand over to her now. It's Patricia McKenna of the Green Party and Campaign Against the EU Constitution.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the invitation to come here tonight. I was just, there is a problem actually with the yes side in that, by and large, they shy away from debating the issues. Now, I have to be fair, even though I'm a Green, I have to say that the Greens, while we don't have a position on it, there was this agreement that, so if I was on the platform, you wouldn't have got a Green on the platform anyway. There was this agreement that we wouldn't debate against each other externally or whatever. But, and I'm not sure whether Trevor Sargent is that engaged in the issue.
You didn't know you were coming.
But what I want to just say is I don't want to waste too much time talking about Prunchies de Rossa, but unfortunately I'm going to waste a bit of it. Two things. One is, Prunchies de Rossa had an attack on me yesterday saying I wanted to privatise the ESB. He was going back to questions I'd asked in the European Parliament. Now, this guy's long enough in the teeth to know the difference between privatisation and liberalisation. I asked questions in relation to the fact that the ESB, you know, controls the electricity grid and is owner of the electricity grid, and then was trying to be bidding to get, in relation to wind energy, to be the supplier, bidding out all the little small wind energy people around the country who were actually trying to get on the grid. So I'd ask questions in relation to that because there was a huge conflict of interest there, and it was about, you know, decoupling. But de Rossa tried to turn that around and say I was looking for the ESB to be privatised. Now, how he could actually decipher that from the questions I'd asked, it was about small wind energy people trying to actually get their businesses off the ground and get their electricity onto the grid. But of course, the ESB has complete monopoly there, and it's a major problem. But it's interesting to see how de Rossa turns things around. The other thing I just want to say, he's got some cheek, I mean, just looking at this leaflet, in talking about, you know, advancing the rights of European citizens. Prunchies de Rossa was the only Irish MEP to vote against an amendment in the European Parliament on the Lisbon Treaty calling for the European Parliament to respect the outcome of the Irish referendum. There was an motion put down saying that the European Parliament would respect the outcome of the Irish referendum. 499 members of the European Parliament voted to reject that. In other words, and 129 voted in favour, including our Irish MEPs, Bar de Rossa. So it shows the arrogance and also the contempt for democracy, you know, that this man can display without batting an eyelid. He basically voted to ignore the result of the Irish referendum if the European Union so wished, so much for democracy. Having said that, the European Parliament can't push ahead with anything anyway. The other thing I just wanted to mention was in relation to what we're debating about on this issue, just before I get into the treaty itself. I would say all of you got this little booklet, you know, it's the actual amendment to the Irish Constitution, Os Gaeilge and Os Berla. Now, if you actually go to that, you will see in section 10, it talks about the state may ratify the Treaty of Lisbon, amending the treaties of European Union and the treaty establishing the European Union, signed at Lisbon on whatever date, blah, blah, blah. And it goes on to say, and may be a member of the European Union established by virtue of that treaty. Now, that actually makes it quite clear that it is a new European Union that is being established. And I'll come back to that again, because the original proposal, which was called an EU constitution, was rejected, but it's been put back again. And that makes that quite clear, that this is the creation of a new European Union. The second thing, then, is in relation to the amendment to our Irish constitution, is section 11. It says, no provision of this constitution invalidates laws enacted, acts done, or measures adopted by the state that are necessitated by the obligations of membership of the said union. And it also talks about or prevents laws enacted, acts done, or measures adopted by the said European Union or by its institutions thereof or bodies competent under the treaties referred to in this section from having the force of law in the state. So what we're talking here about is amending our constitution in such a way that the powers within it, which the founders of this state had actually perceived as being the people would decide. You look at Article 6 of the Irish Constitution, all power comes from the people, and only the people have the final say. And that is why we're having a referendum in the first place, because it was the late Raymond Crossley who went to the Supreme Court and fought for the Irish people's right to decide if they wanted to hand over power to the European Union and not for the government to do that. And the Supreme Court said, yes, that's quite right. The Irish government have no right to hand over our powers enshrined within our constitution without our permission. And here they're asking for our permission to sign over basically our whole constitution. Now that's a thing to remember, regardless of, you know, what might be good or bad within this treaty. The next thing I want to come to, I suppose being a Green, I have to mention this issue because I see De Rossa talks about it, climate change. There are six words added. The original wording of the constitution was the EU would promote measures at international level to deal with regional or worldwide environmental problems. And the inclusion of, and in particular, combating climate change. Now, this does is restate what the EU is doing already, that at international level it's promoting the issue of climate change. It does not give the EU any new powers internally on environmental to act on environmental problems, because any new measures the EU will take will have to be, as it currently is, they will have to be reconciled with the rules on distorting competition, safeguarding the internal market and sustaining the energy market. So there are no new environmental powers given to the EU by virtue of this treaty. And on climate change, the only thing it does is state what the EU is already doing, promoting climate change at international level. The EU is not going to stop promoting climate change at international level if we reject this treaty. For a start off, it would be irresponsible of them to do that. But then, secondly, the reality is they're not going to do it. But if you actually take the issue of climate change, there's a very worrying aspect to this treaty. There is a legally binding protocol on Euratom. Now, Euratom is the treaty which is designed, and I'll quote from the treaty itself, is designed to promote the nuclear industry. It talks about creating the conditions necessary for the speedy establishment and growth of the nuclear industries. It talks about facilitating investment to develop nuclear energy. Now, take that. The nuclear industry are very happy with the Lisbon Treaty because the nuclear industry are pushing the issue of nuclear being the solution to climate change. And this is going to open the door wide for the nuclear industry with the European taxpayers' support to expand the nuclear industry. I'm not saying there'll be nuclear power stations in Ireland or anything like that, but there will definitely be an expansion of them under the guise of combating climate change at a European level. And we will be importing the electricity on the grid, so, and we'll be funding it as well, so we're part and parcel of the whole scenario. The other thing I just want to mention in relation to just democracy and small countries, there are a few provisions within this treaty which will be worrying for a lot of people. One is the loss of a commissioner for 5 out of every 15 years. The commission is the only body within the EU that has the power to initiate laws, to propose laws. And we will be out of that equation, away from that table, for 5 out of every 15 years. Now, it's been argued, so will all the other countries. It doesn't matter. Germany's going to be away as well. But they are not comparing like with like. And I want to go on to the second issue before I come back to that again, is the Council of Ministers. Within the Council of Ministers, there's a new voting system proposed. It's what's called a double majority. 55% of member states and 65% of populations have to agree before something can go forward. But a minimum of 4 member states with a population of 35% plus 1 can block anything. And why am I saying that's important? It means that at the Commission table, when, for example, big countries like Germany aren't there, they may not be there, but their opinion will be taken into account. Why? Because Germany, with one other big country and 2 small countries, can block anything. So the Commission aren't going to push forward with something that the big countries they know are not going to support. What if the Commission are proposing something and Ireland isn't at the table? Well, with 0.8% on the population-based criteria, we have a heck of a lot of chance of blocking anything, unless we're supported by Germany, which of course then means that the issue doesn't arise in the first place. So it's very important for small countries to be at that table. Gareth Fitzgerald, John Bruton and a horde of Irish politicians have argued over the years that the Commission is very smart, important for small countries. Now that they've lost that fight, they're turning around saying it doesn't really matter, it's not important. So those two things are extremely important, and also in relation to the Council of Ministers voting, because of the fact that a huge number of areas are moving to what's called qualified majority voting, where we don't have the power to block anything anymore, and our voting strength within the Council of Ministers on the population criteria reduces. Germany's doubles, because it doubles. Ireland's over halves. We go down from 2 to 0.8%. So those kind of things really need to be taken into account in relation to our influence in the future, you know, policies of Europe. The other thing I want to go on to is military, because it's extremely important. That's why I got involved in the issue in the first place. There are a number of things. We're told, by the way, neutrality is protected. First of all, what they're talking about neutrality is they say we won't sign up to a common defence. But questions asked by Tony Gregory in the Dáil there recently show that the government doesn't even have a clue what common defence is. They have no definition of it. So we're going to not join something that they don't know what it is that they're talking about. We're not going to join. But within this treaty, there is a mutual defence clause in Article 28A, it makes it quite clear that mutual defence clause is very similar in wording to the NATO clause. And you will be told that, oh, it talks about in accordance with Article 51 of the UN Charter. Article 5, the mutual defence clause within NATO, also talks about that. It goes on to say that it shall not prejudice the specific character and security of defence policy of certain member states. That was back in the Maastricht Treaty. We've joined the Rapid Reaction Force, we've joined the European Battle Groups, we've joined the European Defence Agency. Come on! I mean, that was there at Maastricht, and we're still doing everything militarily that the EU wants us to do. But what's interesting is, within the mutual defence clause, it talks about that it shall be consistent with the commitments under NATO. So that's first and foremost. A mutual defence clause is also a mutual solidarity clause. Oh God, I have a lot to get through in a few minutes. There's a mutual solidarity clause as well, which talks about, and they expand what's called the Petersburg task. The Petersburg tasks are what defines the EU military actions, and within that they've expanded it to include things like combating terrorism, but also, you know, talking about like possible terrorist strikes and preemptive sort of measures against. So in other words, it's a blank check, because when you talk about possible terrorist attacks and possible, you're saying, right, we can go and we can attack that country if we so wish, under the guise that we believe that they're going to, you know, carry out a terrorist attack in some member state of the EU. It's a blank check, and it's completely in breach, as far as we can see, of the United Nations Charter. There is no requirement within this treaty for a UN mandate, by the way. But what's also very concerning for me is two things. One, that we have to, and I quote, member states shall undertake progressively to improve their military capabilities. So what does that mean? It means we have to spend more on military. But what's even more worrying, and I watched the origins of this agency and how it came about. When I was elected to the European Parliament in 1994, I was just amazed at the amount of lobbying that was going on by the European arms industries with the European Commission. And they were bemoaning the fact that since the end of the Cold War, there was this big slump in arms sales, and we have to do something in Europe to boost the arms industry so they can compete at a global level. So what they did was they lobbied, and in Amsterdam, they got the wheels in motion in relation to the setting up of the European Armaments Agency. It's called, by the way, the European Defence Agency now. So this, and you can actually go to the Transnational Corporation's website, you can actually see Foundation, and you can find a very good history of how this agency was set up, and the arms industries and everything that were involved, all the key ones in Europe. So basically you have an agency that was set up at the behest of the arms industry, with the arms industry behind it pulling the strings. And what role is it given within this treaty? It talks about that the agency shall identify operational requirements, shall promote measures to satisfy those requirements, shall contribute to identifying and, where appropriate, implementing any measures needed to strengthen the industrial and technological base of the defence sector, and shall participate in defining a European capabilities and armaments policy. And later on in the treaty, it talks about, with the European Defence Agency, that it shall assess member states. The agency shall contribute to the regular assessment of participating member states' contributions with regard to capabilities. And that these assessments would then be the basis for council recommendations and decisions. So you have in fact the arms industries of Europe deciding on how EU member states, including Ireland, will increase their military capabilities, how they will spend their money on military. It's like asking the pharmaceutical industries to actually decide and determine and assess how doctors fill in prescriptions and what drugs they put on those prescriptions. I mean, this is just ridiculous, and there is no highlighting of this issue at all in relation to the vested interests of the European arms industry and the amount of power and control they will have in the future. The other issue here within this treaty is what's called structured cooperation. Now, structured cooperation will allow the more sort of military powerful and the more military ambitious member states to get together and forge ahead with the creation of a kind of a force as such. And the French have already proposed, the French, the Germans, the Italians, the British, they're already planning this. They've already the wheels are already in motion. They were told by the Irish to keep it under wraps. It was in Le Figaro a couple of weeks ago, there was a report that the French white paper on defence and security was ready to be published, but that the Irish government had told them to keep it quiet until after the 12th of June, when the Irish had voted, because it would create alarm bells here and it would give the no side strong arguments in relation to the Lisbon Treaty and the consequences of it. So you will have a kind of a more military strong force which can actually go and do as it wishes using the resources of the EU, using the funding of the EU and on behalf of the EU, and only the member states within this structured cooperation agreement will have the right to say and vote and whatever within that. So you're stuck between a rock and a hard place in relation to the Irish, or the inside or the outside. If they're outside, they have no say, but yet the resources that the Irish are putting into the European Union and the fact that this will work on behalf of and operate on behalf of the European Union leaves a major problem. And we're told there's nothing in this is scaremongering to suggest that, well, I think the word neutrality probably is a word that's kind of at this stage has lost its meaning in Ireland, but it's quite clear. How long have I got?
Another 5 minutes.
It's quite clear, like, that you need to sort of broaden it out and not just talk about neutrality, but talk about the further militarisation of Europe. And the Irish government say, oh well, we still have a veto in these areas. We have signed up to the everything that's going. We have never vetoed anything. We are involved in the Rapid Reaction Force, the battle groups, the Defence Agency. Denmark actually is the only country not involved in the Defence Agency. And the Defence Agency, the other problem with incorporating the Defence Agency into this treaty means you give it legal status within the treaty. Now, there was people who would actually question the legality of the establishment of this agency to begin with. It was established during the Thessalonica summit. The Irish government agreed to it, up to it and participated in it without any problem. No dull debate, no dull discussion on this, and still, even though we're participating in these meetings and we're even sending Enterprise Ireland to these meetings, there is no dull debate, no openness, no transparency on what the heck Enterprise Ireland are doing there and what we're planning for the future. And there was no decision of members of the Dáil in relation to Ireland's participation in this. So on the one hand, we have the Irish government telling us and the people on the yes side that neutrality is protected and that we have no problem here and that if it comes to a common defence, you will have a referendum on it. But, I mean, as I said, what is a common defence, you know? What more do we need? What more provisions are there? There is a not huge amount of provisions within this for the military. The military progress of Europe, nothing can actually hold it back, whether Ireland is participating in everything, which of course it has up to now, or not, is neither here nor there, because the provisions are put in this treaty to allow everything to go ahead. Now, as I said, there are a couple of industries very keen on this treaty. One would be the arms industries and the other would be the nuclear industry in relation to the provisions that it gives. Now, I just wanted to mention two other things before I finish, and one is, as I said, you know, the issue of why we're having this referendum in the first place is not the generosity of our own political establishment. It's because they were forced to, in 1986, they tried to ratify an EU treaty without going to the people. And there were an individual, the late Raymond Crotty, went to the courts and challenged them and fought for the right of Irish people to have a say in the handing over of their constitutional rights enshrined within our constitution. And as a result, we've had referendums on every treaty since, and the campaigns in every single treaty since has been the same. You'll hear the argument of, oh, you're always on the no side, you said no to every treaty. But they've said yes to everything. When is it too much? When is it going to be too much, and when are they going to have the courage to say no, hold on here? And we also have to remember that the French and the Dutch have rejected basically the same thing. This is a regurgitated version of the EU constitution rejected by the French and the Dutch voters. And I quote Giscard d'Estaing. He said, the Treaty of Lisbon is the same as the rejected constitution. Only the format has been changed to avoid referendums. He also said at a talk he gave in London there last year that public opinion will be led to adopt, without knowing it, the proposals that we dare not present to them directly. All the original proposals, he says, will be in the new text, which is this here, hidden and disguised in some way, but the substance has been retained. And he says, what was already difficult to understand is now incomprehensible. And Amato, the vice chair of the Convention on Europe, said, the good thing about not calling it a constitution is that people cannot demand a vote on it. So what they did was they took this back, regurgitated in the most difficult way possible, and put it back out there, the same thing, the same proposal. That's why I think it's very important, this amendment to our constitution, that it accepts the fact that it's a new European Union established by virtue of this treaty. And finally, just in relation to democracy and people's right to vote, we are fortunate that we had a written constitution that was drafted in such a way that politicians couldn't take total control. The French and the Dutch voted no. And Sarkozy has openly admitted that, you know, the French were just ahead of all the others in voting no. If we had a referendum in all member states, it would be rejected there too. And he says on this, you know, on the regurgitated version, he says, we're not having a referendum. He says, because if we had a referendum, the French people would again reject it, and that would trigger referendums in other countries where it would again be rejected. And don't forget, Sarkozy was elected. So this is the argument they say as well about the French. Oh, and the French people, yes, they rejected the treaty, Dick Roach said. But, you know, in the presidential election, you had, I think it was 10 candidates, and only one of them was proposing that there would be no referendum on the treaty. And that was Sarkozy, and he got elected. Sarkozy's platform was that they would have a slimmed-down mini-treaty with no referendum. Did we get a slimmed-down mini-treaty? No, we didn't. We got a treaty that's over 7,000 words longer than the original treaty, but 55 pages less. How did they manage that? They changed the font size and took out the line spacing. That's the kind of contemptuous attitude of the political elite in Europe to the citizens of Europe. So this is not what citizens want. Not here, not in any other country in Europe, and the ones who have been asked already have said no, and I hope that we in Ireland have the courage to do the same. And in the last few days of this campaign, I'd appeal to everybody, get out there and get across the message that Europe is not going to come to a standstill if we say no. It's going to continue as it is, and you can actually see that quite clearly. But if we say yes, we're giving the political powers in Europe carte blanche to do what they like in future without coming back to us. And there is a provision in this treaty for a self-amendment, Article 48, and it does mean that if they so decide to amend the treaties further in future, that we in Ireland will not be able to go into the Supreme Court like Raymond Crotty did and fight for the right for a referendum. Because in the Crotty case, and I'll finish on this point, in the Crotty case he won on one argument only, and that was that within the Single European Act there was new spheres of competence brought in, and the Supreme Court said that the people, when they originally voted to join the EU, could not have foreseen these new areas of competence. Whereas in all other areas they should have foreseen. So if we went into the Supreme Court after we say yes to this and said, oh well look, the Irish government have agreed to something under Article 48 that they're going to give up this and this, the Supreme Court said, look, you should have known that when you voted for this, that's what you voted for, you voted to give them permission to do that. You can't come back and ask for, you know, to have the right to vote to give them permission a second time. So I'll finish on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Patricia. You mentioned the Crotty case. You didn't mention the McKenna case.
Yeah, well,
which gave us this, where the government have to spend equal amounts of money. Maybe you could come back in later on that.
Well, actually, I'll just say on that, it's a disappointment. The McKenna case meant that the government could not spend money on one side promoting it, so they set up the referendum commission, a great idea, but after we voted no in Nice 1, what did the government do? They amended the referendum act to take away from the referendum commission the role of getting the yes and no arguments from the public and putting those yes and no arguments back out in a legally vetted way. So as a result, you have a complete farce. It's a waste of money and a waste of time. It's a very big, and I fought hard for the right for the referendum commission to be established, but this new government did not reinstate the role of the referendum commission to actually give out the yes and no arguments, and that's all three parties in government were requested to do so and didn't do so.
Okay. We get these wonderful ads on television with half bodies. I don't get it at all. We're going to open it
half
up to
story.
Open it up to the floor for questions to our speakers, and after that we'll come back for sum ups from the speakers. Okay.
Thanks,
Chris.
Very good. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Take care. Bye-bye. If you just raise your hand and I'll take you in some sort of order.
Yeah, just to maybe say that when I was working with Brian, I'm a member of the Socialist Party, and we obviously played a role in trying to pull this meeting together. But I also want to speak in my capacity as a trade unionist and a member of the Impact. And one of the things that's been used to try and muddy the water about the no side is the fact that you do have this division within the wider trade union movement, some of which are calling for a no vote, some of which are calling for a yes vote. But behind that, there's a certain story to be told, and it's about, you know, democracy in action or democracy not in action, whichever way you look at it. But it seems to me that any union that in any way has deliberated over the pros and cons of this treaty from a trade union perspective has arrived at a no position. Unite, which is the second biggest state union on the island of Ireland. and the TWU, which organises electricians and technicians, about 45,000 members. I'm a member of Impact, which is the biggest public service union, organises some 60,000 people across the health sector, local government and so on. We had our biennial conference there a few weeks ago, and one of the 151 motions that were down for discussion was precisely that the union circulate to its membership the pros and cons of Lisbon from a trade union perspective. Now, during the course of that union conference, that we weren't always dealing with the 151 motions, but we had to endure a speech from Brian Cowan, the Taoiseach, where he devoted a good third of a speech to promote the Lisbon Treaty. We had David Begg from the Irish Congress of Trade Unions invited to speak, and again he gave a heavy plug, giving a very one-sided account in terms of how, you know, the Charter of Fundamental Human Rights upholds the right to strike and so on and so forth. And Peter McClune, the Impact General Secretary, likewise gave a speech where he gave his opinion that he, within the ICTU Congress, which was discussing whether ICTU would recommend a yes or no, would personally be recommending a yes. And there was no sense that there was any discussion at even executive level. And of course, the motion to actually discuss it in conference about the union promoting the pros and cons from a union perspective, that fell because of time. It was deferred. It didn't get discussed, which to me just demonstrated another contempt for democracy even within a trade union level. There's a member of the Civil and Public Service Union as well, who I'm sure he has a story to tell about how their general secretary has publicly been identified as a leading trade unionist for the treaty, and yet there's been no discussion or procedure as far as I know within the CPSU to arrive at that position. Just the other observations I'd make about is that it seems to me that, like all constitutions, I mean, that this is a constitution, that it's so voluminous in terms of that you could say, yes, here it says that that this right is upheld, the right to strike, the right to organise. And of course there's a number of other articles that we've already identified which say no, it's not that there's a primacy in terms of competition, and that's what all constitutions are like in the type of society we live in. Now, when you have those conflicts of rights, well, then it's the role of the courts to kind of to work out which is prime, and it's already been demonstrated in the terminology that's used. They refer to distortions of competition. That's a euphemism, not just in terms of that governments cannot invest in public services because it distorts competition, but that strike action can also distort competition, and strikes can only be allowed insofar as that they don't distort the competition. And my reading is that the strikes can only be permitted up until the point that they're effective strikes, and thereafter they're illegal. So they have to be illegal. I just want to finish by just making two practical points, that this meeting was called under the umbrella of the campaign against the EU constitution, that people should take away handfuls of the campaign's literature at the back. There's both a pamphlet which kind of goes into some detail about the provisions of the treaty, but also the leaflets that people should give out. But also just a financial thing that I never mentioned this to the chair, that this room costs €75, so there should be a collection at the very end. People should just donate a couple of euro before they end.
Thank you very much. I don't know if people are shielding themselves from the sun or raising their hand. Another speaker? Another questioner?
Me? Yeah. My name is Terry Kelleher. I work in the post office, which we don't have to wait for the Lisbon Treaty to discover what Europe means for the postal service. In 2011, it will be the whole postal market will be open to full competition, and anybody, DHL, Royal Mail, can come in and set up and try and compete with on post. That's already happening. There is a company called Ireland DX, which only really operates in the main urban areas, and particularly in Dublin, where there's more profit to be made, and actually delivers 1 million items a year, but it's a very small operation. On the run up to 2011, on post have been told they have to shred 1,200 jobs. We have to close down hundreds of post offices. And at the moment, what's been forced on the unions is a whole layer of yellow pack grades. Anybody that comes in now starts at a basic of €450 a week. Which is extremely low. That's what liberalisation means. And like, you can pick out any article or whatever is written, but that is what it's going to mean for every public service and every other market. that is covered by this. Now, that is what they're saying. Is there a way of actually integrating services and integrating markets? What this Lisbon is all about is it's a political and economic programme to allow multinationals operate in a whole number of countries with less regulation, less barriers, and therefore more of a scope to build up multinationals, which ultimately is to rival those in America and other market places. What they could have done is actually said that they could have kept the services like health, like the postal service, and what they should be doing with the health service and education service, right, and the main civil service, is keeping them public and integrating them. They could have done that. And what's really dangerous, or what I find really frightening about the Lisbon, is that it is a constitution with an economic agenda on it. We don't have an economic agenda in a lot of constitutions, but this has a neoliberal policies in the constitution. The question then beckons, what if in one country a left-leaning party is voted in? And do what they had to do, let's say England had to renationalise a major bank, Northern Rock, because it was actually collapsing. So what if a country came in and voted for a left-leaning party? A government came in, wanted to keep the postal service public, not private. And by the way, that could happen, because Royal Mail is in deep, deep, deep trouble. And a report was released 2 months ago by the government, it's on the BBC website, basically saying that the liberalisation of the full liberalisation of the English postal market has been a disaster for business, for customers, and for people. Well, we didn't say that, but it is for workers working in the place. So what happens then? How does a country then overrule the European Constitution? This country, it can't. It is really, really dangerous. The last point I make is, I was at a debate facilitated by my union, which is a civil service union, and Rory Quinn, arguing for Lisbon, made this point. I thought it was a terrible point, but I'll let you make up your own mind. He said, with all the uncertainty of the subprime markets, the financial markets in turmoil, the slowdown in the economy, the collapse of the construction, do we need more uncertainty? Do we need a no vote will be bad for us? I got up and I asked him a question. What created the subprime crisis? What created the financial crisis? And this is accepted by everybody, both on the left and the right, was the deregulation of the financial markets. The deregulation, the financial lenders, big financial money corporations could do what they like when they like, and there was no accountability, or less accountability, brought in under them Thatcher and Reagan era in the 80s. They could do what they like. And that's where we are. What is Lisbon all about? It's about bringing those same, the market will dictate less regulation, but will bring it in to the health service, education service, and a lot of other services, which are much, much more important, will have a direct effect. So actually, there's a huge contradiction if you think about it. And what we've done in our post is, we brought together our shop stewards to read through it, to discuss it, and our shop stewards had only one conclusion. Not only should we vote against it, but actually we should campaign against it. And unfortunately, that has not been the position of this government, actually, to initiate a proper debate among people. They could have had this thing since last December. They could have initiated major debates in workplaces, in communities, in schools, they brought people together. They could have brought, and that's exactly what they haven't done. Except what they've done is, and I'll finish up by this, is, If you don't fall for this, the sky is going to fall down. And that's all they're saying. I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Chair.
I'll take questions as well, if anyone has questions. In the centre, yeah?
Yeah, it's a question towards Patricia, because the the Green Party had a position at its conference, and there was some debate. I don't know if you can give the flavour of that. Both Eamon Ryan and John Gilmore came out last week with the Scottie falling down. Gormley.
They're all sounding the same.
Eamon
Ryan and John Gormley. Eamon Ryan had said there will be chaos. If Ireland votes no, and John Gormley was speaking at a conference in England, I think it was, but he was talking about the vote and the treaty, and he said it would be a massive setback for the climate change agenda,
which is a hoax anyway.
So he said that, and I know like you're campaigning against it, and you spoke very well, but. I wonder how, in terms of since the conference and then the position within the Green Party, how's all that? What's your perspective on that?
Okay, anybody else? Questions, comments?
I just have one. It's just about actually the global warming thing. Now, I know it's like it's nothing different than the Lisbon Treaty, but I was all for, you know, global warming, dangerous and all that, but. If you look at a lot of stuff on the internet, it's looking at if, you know what I mean, Al Gore and all. He was the one that's behind a lot. He turned up a lot of limos, you know what I mean? So people are going to look at that as well. That's another thing, you know, with scaremongering. You know, you wonder, there's a lot of stuff behind that. What are you going to use with the money that's taxed from a carbon footprint or whatever? What are you going to use that money for? Just like with the... There's a good thing on the internet you get called Endgame. And it's about the North American Union and the European superstate. And basically you want to build a toll road right up through Mexico, through America and into Canada. You know what I mean? Stuff like that, you know what I mean? It's us.
Thank you. That's a mic. It's a quick question. Just the moment the Top the Yes campaign has been... Sorry, the moment the Top the Yes campaign has been quite successful in kind of muddying waters and kind of saying, look, don't worry, you're pretty little head about it. Which because it's very complicated, you don't need to be, and because of that, just from general conversations with other people, they're quite apathetic about the treaty and don't seem to see any dangers that are just coming through. And I suppose just a concern would be that even if a no vote does come in, as with Nice, is it not just going to be railroaded through in a few months afterwards anyway? You know what I mean? 6 months again, we'll be back at the polls with just more money being spent and more media driven type thing, or else it will just be pushed through in a different way.
I'd echo that. I'd, you know, maybe ask myself, you know, should there be a no vote? Let's hope there is. You know, what can we do to copper fasten that?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that. I was going to back up this point. That's what a lot of people are afraid of. A lot of people have a sort of a gut feeling that, you know, there is reasons to vote no, but they're afraid that because they're thinking, oh shit, like, you know, what's going to happen to our economy and stuff, you know what I mean? So people are just used to voting yes and agreeing with things just out of fear of voting no, you know what I mean?
Just to briefly on a couple of points, I think it's been clear in the last few weeks that despite the overwhelming, and I think it's actually quite stark this time around than at any other time, but the bias in the media towards the yes side is incredible. I mean, probably the Irish Times, which holds itself up as the paper of record and all the rest of it. I was looking at it there, I think it was Saturday, I think it was 9 articles which referenced Lisbon. 7 of them were pro. And if you see, it's quite clever what they're doing. People like Mark Hennessy or Stephen Collins, the big writers for the likes of these papers, the yes side need to get their act together. The yes side need to, and it's a subtle way of putting pro Lisbon material into the media, or whatever. But it's been quite stark about how biased the media have been, particularly in that type of particular newspaper that prides itself on being the paper record, which is clearly not in this context. But I think it's also interesting. I mean, what happened in the last few days with the ICMSA and the IFA? I think once the ICMSA came out in favour of yes, I think it was probably inevitable that the government would go behind the scenes and try and force the IFA to come out in favour of yes. But what it clearly demonstrates is the panic that exists amongst the government. And I actually think, I know Trish is still a member of the Green Party, I think that's more what people like Eamon Ryan's comments and John Gorman's and Kieran Cuff today, which is the worst of them all, particularly in the where he came out and said that the No campaign was a neocons, spuckers and Trotskyites, which is somewhat akin to the type of things that actually were levelled at the Green Party with sandal-wearing blue lass and all the rest of it for years. But it's an indicator, in my opinion, that actually what it reflects is a panic amongst the government about what's taking place. But I think it also, for example, with the Greens, I think because they were somewhat abstaining from the debate in an official sense, I think the likes of Council, hold on a minute, he's out getting criticised for having an attack at the Fine Gael, and he's a member of his government who are not participating. And I'd say that's what partly a reaction to. And I think the overreaction in those comments reflects the panic amongst the SNP that they feel that they were losing it. And certainly in the last week or two, the momentum has been behind the No campaign. I think it's still probably behind the polls, but it's behind it. And I think it is full steam ahead for the next week and a half. I think for No to win, I think it would be, if it was to happen, it would be a massive achievement in the context of all the points about the media bias and all the rest of it. It's very significant. But I also think, you know, they may rerun with it. I think Mary Wallace made a comment over the weekend that there would be a second round of referendum, and that may be the case. And it's not really the issue. The point is to vote No now. Let's see what happens further down the line. But I also don't think a lot of people, and I'd say for people in this room, I don't think a lot of us believe that if you vote No, that some of the things that have been put forward are going to be stopped. It takes more than that. Vote No is very, very important, but then it's about developing campaigns on all the issues, whether it be privatisation or whether it be militarism or climate change or any of these type of things. It's up to people themselves to get out and organise and demonstrate. But just one point about, you know, if you look what's happened in the last few weeks in France in terms of Sarkozy's policies, what he's doing in terms of attacking pension rights, attacking works conditions, education cuts, all the rest of it. If you see what's happened with Merkel in Germany, if you see what's happened in terms of the new right-wing government in Sweden, somehow the yes side are saying all these governments are implementing all these economic attacks, but yet they've come up with this treaty that defends workers' rights as opposed to privatisation. It's ludicrous in the extreme, the idea that they're implementing one thing and they've somehow come up with a treaty that defends all the things that they're already implementing. It's absolute nonsense in the extreme. And I think that in itself, things, even small things like the quote Claire gave about the IBEC, from what IBEC said, how can anything that's in the interests of IBEC and big business be also in the interests of workers? The two don't go hand in hand. They're a complete contradiction. And in that sense, in a simple way, if IBEC are for it, well, then I think workers should be opposed to it.
Thank you very much. At the back?
Yeah, just on the basis of campaigning, I noticed that over the last couple of weeks, Boris Johnson winning the London mayoral election, they said a lot about him focusing on the boroughs. And that was the way he won the popular vote. I'm from Malahide, so I got the bus in here. Now, I noticed yesterday Core had put up a few kind of diamond-shaped posters saying vote No. I don't really agree with their approach to the thing, but they seem to be the only ones, aside from a few posters I saw for this meeting, actually targeting Malahide, Kilmarnock and the outerlying areas. So from a lot of people I've spoken to, it's a matter of perception. So they see the vast majority of people putting up yes, Fianna Fáil, they've got all the faces, they know all the faces going in there. And they see it's just the dissenters on the extreme left or right that are going to do it, even though there are reasonable arguments. And I'm preaching the convert here, I'm going to be voting no on it. But I'm wondering, is there going to be a step up in the campaign and step up in postering in outlying areas? I know the city's been well covered, but the suburbs aren't getting any attention for the no side. And if in fact there are any posters to go around, I'll happily put them on.
Thank you very much. I know there's people here whose hands are sore and are ladder weary from putting up posters. I'd also note that the Fianna Fáil posters went up by the same crew that put up the IBEC posters. Every second lamppost, very convenient.
Yeah, I was just wondering, do you think it'd be any more effective? Last week before, like, I was chatting to this guy here about the posters and all, I was thinking, you know, Total Fitness there at the Hilton Hotel, would it be any more effective to actually stand with the posters, you know, when the traffic is busy? So people actually see, they don't just see a poster, they see people with the poster. Will it make people think, you know, that the people that are voting for the No campaign are putting in more effort and just putting a good poster up?
I'd say breadboarding, no. I'd say just leave us at the back table and getting them out and talking to people will probably be best time spent. I'm going to go back to our speakers and give them the 60 seconds. So I'm up only messing with 60 seconds. And we're going to go to our last speaker first, so that's to Professor McKenna.
Okay, thanks. I just took a notice of the various different questions. Just on the last one, I know that People's Movement had some posters. I was just going to text somebody and see if they had any that you could put out in Malahide. Yeah, maybe I'll go backwards on the questions. The problem with the postering is that most of the organisations involved have very, very little resources, and the posters they have gone up, and they're tiny, you know, they're pittance compared to what the Yes side have. Like, that's the big problem. The People's Movement of some posters, the Socialist Party, Socialist Workers Party, People for Profit, Sinn Féin. Then you have the Core group, you have the Libertas group, they're the only group with money. And they have some posters up, billboards and posters. But other than them, most of the people on the No side don't actually have the flame. It's desperate. It's really frustrating, the resources. I'd like to hear those quotes of Ciarán Coffs. I didn't hear that today at all, but that sounds bad, all right. Bias in the media. I'm just going to work backwards through these questions. And you're so right about the Irish Times. But I've been watching the Irish Times now for the last number of months since, you know, last year there. And it's interesting, even on their approach on the forum in Europe, when there was any critical person speaking, invited to speak at the forum in Europe, you just take, go back and just print them out and see. The approach to the reports, Angela Merkel, Wallström, Barroso, Bertie Ahern, Brian Cowan, whoever it was, just quoting what they were saying, no little paragraphs in between about anybody challenging anything they were saying. Then took Jens Peter Bond, the only two plenary sessions devoted to the No side, all the ones were on the Yes side. The forum in Europe was a joke as well, I have to say. The only two on the No side were Jens Peter Bond and Gerry Adams. And if you look at both those reports and how they reported on them, they reported a bit of what they said. Oh, but Fine Gael, Liberal, there's a challenge to them on that. And there was challenges the whole way through the article, knocking every little bit they said afterwards by someone on the Yes side. And the same with, then there was a kind of debates, a couple of debates in the forum, one with Susan George and one with Mary Lou McDonald and one with Joe Higgins. Those are the three. But they were only debates. They weren't plenary sessions. But again, they did the same. The way the media approached it is just, the Irish Times in particular is appalling. The thing about fear about the economy, if we vote no, that is a genuine fear that people are actually scared, you know, because there's this economic sort of uncertainty ahead, and do we need any more uncertainty, and how do you get around it? I think the message has to be that things stay the same within the European Union, and maybe because what's the next, will it make us vote again, that they, you know, because maybe that should be tied into it, that if we vote no, things are going to remain the same, and remind people that the French and the Dutch already voted no, and it is going to be different. I don't think they can make us vote again. I think the French and the Dutch are very unhappy with the fact that their decision was completely ignored, and I think there will be, you take the opinion polls right throughout Europe, it's massive. The numbers up in the 70s in some cases, I mean, of people who actually want to vote on this referendum. It's huge. So, you know, there is no way. The lowest is Slovenia, 55%. But you've 87%, 83, 83, 82, 81, 88, 77, blah, blah, blah. I mean, everybody out there wants to vote, and they've been denied the right to vote. So I think this will be a massive wake-up call, and I don't think they'll get away with it. And the same thing, I mean, these people are asking us to vote on it, have admitted that they haven't read the treaty themselves, and they have the gall to turn around and demean us and rubbish us when they haven't even bothered to look at it themselves, and they just expect people to go out and, you know, blindly do what they're told. Well, I hope that day is over. On global warming, you know, what is it true? I mean, well, I genuinely think global warming is happening. It is true. Yes, you have people like Al Gore making massive amounts of money out of it. Somebody tried to get him recently to speak at an event, and they were gobsmacked when they found out how much it cost. And they did try to organise it here in Ireland, and it was just impossible because of the fees he charges. I mean, this guy is like the old fella from the Moonies, you know, the religious cult where the guy who left the Moonies and became a deprogrammer. He was to make, it's all about money and profit, you know. The thing about the Green Party, yeah, there was quite a number of questions on the Green Party in the debate. Like, one of the things I have to say about the Green Party is the only political party in this country that actually asked its membership its opinion on it. Granted, we didn't get a majority, a two-thirds majority on the No side, but they didn't get a two-thirds majority on the Yes side. Yes, they got a majority on the Yes side, and I suppose that's it. That was the position of some of the members. But and I think the climate change argument was one that sort of won people over, even though it's spurious. There is no grounds for arguing that climate change is going to be, that there's anything that forwards the climate change issue in this treaty. It's nonsense. And I think that the nuclear thing, people are still unaware of it, and it's very hard to get this across in the media, but the nuclear, the legally binding protocol, And at the time of the Convention on Europe, John Gormley said it basically put a bomb under the Constitution. Johannes Vogenhuber, who represented the Green Group in the European Parliament at the Convention, they voted against it. They said, you know, it was really because they were against the whole nuclear agenda. So, like, it is there, and it's really worrying as to what will go on. You know, so, in relation to the Greens, I mean, yes, they're divided internally, but I think, and it comes back to the very first question that was asked about the trade unions being, people will argue that, you know, the no side are divided in relation, and that even the trade unions are divided and all that, but inside all of the political parties, there is massive division. The day after our conference, on the Lisbon Treaty, when the John Gormley and them went back into the Dáil, some of the people both in Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael said to them, you know, we couldn't have had that sort of conference to ask our members. We would never have got it through. So within all these political parties, there are divisions. For example, there are a good few Libertas people who would be Fine Gael supporters and Fianna Fáil supporters as well, who were actually working for them. So there's no unified, there's a unified front of the political leadership out there, but when it comes to the no side, you know, they try and point to the divisions within the no side, but they don't point, they hide the divisions within the yes side. And there clearly are a lot of divisions within the yes side, but they're basically hiding them for until this campaign is over, and they're pretending that they don't exist. And even, I mean, the IBEC was a very good example, where Brendan Butler, you know, at the Forum on Europe, said that the Lisbon Treaty would bring opportunities to make money out of health, education and other public services. And IBEC have since backtracked on this. And why have they backtracked? They backtracked because the rest of the people on the yes side said, take that out, tone that down, get rid of it. We can't give them ammunition on the no side. The same as the leaked documents that come out that were reported in the international media about tone down anything that might cause a problem, you know, keep anything under wraps that might cause a problem. Let's keep the Irish voters in the dark and don't give them any opportunity or any arguments that they can actually use. And that's what's going on. And IBEC are playing, all the people on the yes side are playing ball on this. The issue about constitution with an economic agenda, somebody mentioned that. I mean, it is true. I mean, you do not have a constitution, is not something that enshrines policy. Policy is something that people vote parties in an election, and they can pursue whatever kind of policy they like. And at the next election, if you don't actually like the policies been pursued by that government, you have the opportunity, you may not succeed, but you have the opportunity to try and vote them out and change the people who are making decisions on your behalf. But within the European constitution, and that's basically what this is again, you're enshrining policy within a constitution. I mean, it's been unheard of. Look at the American constitution, look at our own constitution, or you look at any constitution internationally. They don't enshrine policy within it. That is something for governments to decide as their governments come and go, or as the people decide. The other thing I just wanted to say, I think I've covered most of the questions, haven't I? I think so. Was there anything else? No.
Quick question for you.
Yeah.
From me. A Green yes can't debate a Green no. Did you debate one on the RTÉ website by video?
Oh, yes, that's interesting. Yes, there was. That was not done, to my knowledge, right? RTÉ, because we had this agreement. Well, no written agreements, I have to say, but it was just kind of a gentleman's or, you know, whatever agreement, that we weren't going to sort of go, you know, against each other publicly. Even though I told John, even though I was quoted as saying, I was asked a question at a press conference there recently, and I got kind of caught off the hop. They said that John Gormley had said that, you know, he was part of the convention and he supported the treaty, because I was gobsmacked at that. Probably had I been prepared for it, but I said, look, if I were John Gormley, I'd keep my head down on this, or keep low or lie low or something, because of the fact that John had been in the convention, he voted against the original constitution, and this is the same thing. He voted against it and voted for an alternative document. So if it were me, I would not be highlighting the fact that I was part of the convention that drew that up, because I actually voted against it. In relation to, yeah, there's a kind of a sort of an agreement that we won't go on platforms. Now, RTÉ did ask me to do a thing on the environment, right? And I went and I said, who's doing it? You know, and they told me it was Eamon Gilmore or somebody. They gave me a list, but they didn't mention that it was Deirdre de Burke, it was going to be the other side. So that's the way it kind of happened. But by and large, I mean, one of the things I find a bit frustrating, sometimes you go to press conference and the only thing they want like they asked me this quote about Eamon Ryan about chaos. Like, while I personally just think that I don't agree with this approach and this statement, I was there to represent the People's Movement. I didn't want a headline in the paper. And the same with the campaign against the EU Constitution when we had the thing. It was John Gormley that asked me. And he didn't want a headline in the paper the next day, which was all about a division within the Greens and not about the campaign against the EU Constitution or about the treaty itself, because that's completely counterproductive, you know. So that, and it's to try, personally, for me, it's to try and avoid that, because the Greens have had their debate, it's over and done with. But it's, and it's better for other people to raise the score, the points against them, you know.
Thank you very much. We're going to go over to Claire to sum up and close the meeting.
Well, I'll be very brief because Patricia has answered a lot, which is grand and handy for Claire. But just on a couple of the things, I mean, I think it is difficult, you know, for the No campaign in terms of resources, and certainly in terms of the ownership of the media and the bias and the financial input that's been put into the Yes campaign. The No campaign can't compete with that, absolutely ruled out, in terms of its resources. But I think against that backdrop, actually the sort of attitude amongst people, and I'm not saying that, you know, that the No campaign is absolutely growing now and rocketing and going forward, but I think it's quite healthy, and I do think that the remaining period open to us, it's all to play for. I think it would be, you know, the resources that are down backing this Yes campaign are enormous. But in that context, I think the message has got through to a lot of people. And with some people, it can be just simple things. Even the extent of who is pushing this on the Yes side, it has people who don't maybe have the time or the detail to go through it, say, well, there has to be something more to this if these people are so vehemently pushing for a Yes vote and they haven't furthered their interests in other fields. Well, how could it be different on this one? And I do think it would be very important that people would take the leaflets and that we go out and try and get that No vote up to being the maximum that it possibly can. As I say, we have put up some posters in Malahide. I do think, actually, every day there is more No posters going up, even in Swords, from different campaign banners. Even on the way down, I saw ones that I hadn't seen before. And I do think that is quite important, and we just have to build on that. I won't repeat the points made by Patricia. I think the key point here is that a lot of the processes that this treaty enshrines and extends are there already. We know that, like the military aspect, oh, neutrality is defended. What neutrality? When you look at the record of the Irish government, the troops going through Shannon and all the rest of it. But the point is that these take those processes in terms of privatisation, in terms of militarism, and take them further than anything that has gone before. And I think regardless of the outcome on this battle, the campaign and the battle against privatisation and against militarism will continue in any way. But there is no doubt that should the No campaign be successful and deliver a No vote, the enormous blow that that will be to this government, we just cannot understate it. And it's ironic, but particularly against a difficult economic backdrop, and particularly when you see the plans that this government has for making ordinary people pay for that crisis, which was not of our creation in any way. Anything that damages that government, to me, is good for workers. So I do think we should use the time and go out and do one or two of the other little issues that were raised. I do think, in terms of the environmental issues, there's no doubt that while there are huge environmental issues, it's quite a convenient cover for the ruling establishment in many instances to use sincere environmental concerns as a vehicle, say, for extra taxation or so on. And that will become more so. You see it on things like the lobby for the reintroduction of water charges. Again, bin charges were justified on the basis that they were positive for the environment. Yet since the charge was brought in, the amount of waste produced per head of the population has actually increased, but it was all about making money while recycling has gone up, which is good. They haven't done anything to tackle waste at source, because these are real issues. They need to be dealt with, but unfortunately they're being used and abused as revenue generation mechanisms in many instances, and there's no real desire to sort them out. I think in terms of the Greens, I think Patricia's right, this is a meeting about the issues. I do, and I don't in any way you know, query Patricia's sincerity on this. She's been out building this campaign, but it is for people in this area. I mean, we went to Trevor Sargent first as someone who in this constituency in the past had made all of the arguments that we would maybe be making here tonight and asked him to debate them. Now, I know in the local media he said he's supporting a yes vote, but I do think it's different than some of the other parties, because Trevor went to the electorate here making all of those arguments, and now once he's in there, he's done a U-turn. So that's why it's a bit different, because they've gone from, or many of the key people have gone from saying one thing one day to something else the next day without in any way explaining that difference, and that is hard for people to take. I think I'm excluding Patricia from that, but I think the main thing here is that we go out and do whatever we can in the next couple of days that's left to develop the no vote, and I would encourage people to stay around and maybe take some stuff and see what we can do across the board on it, you know.
Back to Patricia for final last comment.
Well, just two things. One, maybe just what you could do, a suggestion is challenge Trevor, whatever, to yourself or Joe or somebody, indeed, to a debate on local radio. Is there a local radio station out here?
Not really.
If you could do something like that or something, you know, where you could actually just, you know. But there was one thing I just want to come back to, because I think if we want to try and get a no vote, there's one thing we have to be very careful about. Now, I've been all over the country, from Donegal to Galway to Tullamore, Cork, Mullingar, wherever. And I'll tell you, there's one thing that we need to be careful, and it's just something Claire said. And while it's very tempting, I would kind of hold back until after the vote, and that is the idea that, you know, this will be embarrassing for the government. Because there are three parties in the government, particularly, the one I'm talking about in particular is Fianna Fáil. There are a lot of Fianna Fáil voters out there who are extremely concerned and are wavering to vote no. And you find this, like, especially outside of Dublin, who are tending to the no vote. That kind of thing will actually, because of this party loyalty, it's incredible, will actually maybe put them, I'm just saying, can put some of them off voting no because of this thing. Yeah, you see, the thing is that we have to try and get across, because I keep saying this, that, look, this is not a general election. This is about our constitution only. And try and avoid mentioning the fact that it might, yes, of course, it'll be a blooming embarrassment to the government, but don't mention that or don't say it, because
the subject of that point.
And sort of, because the people that we have to get, we will have the socialists, we have the various different parties who are on the no side anyway. All those people who vote for them will obviously vote no. The ones we need to get are the Fianna Fáilers, Fine Gaelers and that. So it's to try and appeal to those voters. The diehard members are going to do what they're told anyway, but there are people, and I've noticed that there are people out there who are very urging on voting no. And I mean, there's also, there's another thing I've noticed just in being around the country, that one of the things would be about people who are considering voting no, and their big concern is that the only party on the no side is Sinn Féin, and they're very worried, but they're really sort of reluctant to vote no because the only party voting no is Sinn Féin. They're also associating the posters out there, the red and black posters, with, you know, the ones people died for our freedom, which are Coer posters, but they're actually associating them with Sinn Féin, and it's like a red rag to a bull in some areas. So, you know, they're all, and the media are playing to this. The media have highlighted that, sorry, I shouldn't be going on at length. The media are highlighting this thing about, you know, Sinn Féin being more or less the only, the main sort of no group. They're highlighted quite a lot. I'm not criticising Sinn Féin for being on the no side, but what I'm doing is the media are exploiting this, and it brings me back to, there was a study carried out in 2005 in relation to the Irish referendum, a group called Notre Europe. It was set up as a think tank set up by Jacques Delors. Now, they got funding from the European Commission to carry out a study which was called Securing a Yes Vote. And within that, they identified two things, and that's actually something I meant to mention in relation to the Greens. They identified two things in looking at the past referendum on Nice. What were the assets and what were the pluses and minuses? They identified the Greens as being a major problem because they were seen as honest, trustworthy, wouldn't lie to you, etc., etc. That they were a major problem for the Yes side. And I think that was part of the reasoning behind getting the Greens in government. There was nothing in the programme for government on the Lisbon Treaty, but don't tell me that a year before they knew they were going to have a vote on this, that they didn't consider it and they didn't think about it. It was part of the strategy of this think tank and of the people on the Yes side. They also identified on one of the things was Sinn Féin. They said about Sinn Féin that Sinn Féin were more of an asset to the yes side. So it's interesting that the media are highlighting them, because that will sort of be a switch off for some people, and that they've highlighted the fact that the Greens were, you know, are on the yes side. I mean, technically they're not, you know. Yes, the elected reps are, but the party has no position. But those two things, and it was very interesting to see the whole sort of analysis, and it was basically a study to see how they could get a yes vote in Ireland. And if you watch the whole strategy in relation to the coordination, one of the other things they talked about in that study was coordination between the people on the yes side, and you could see it happening, as you said, the Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, the IBEC, the whole lot. They're even putting up each other's posters. So that's the kind of thing you're up against. That's why I'm saying be careful. Appeal to the Fianna Fáilers and the Fine Gaelers and that who are worried, and especially the Fianna Fáilers in relation to the government, that this is will be no reflection on the government. Yeah, and you can shout afterwards about it.
Three things to close with. Round of applause for our speakers. Leaflets at the back for you to take into your workplaces, to your schools and wherever. Do take them, please. And the financial appeal, I've done some maths, and if we all made a fiver donation, the numbers here would match the rent on the room. Thank you very much. There's a tray at the back table for any donations. Thank you for attending tonight.
Just a quick question. Have you got even one email that, you know, everybody can take that email? This email is a great way, you know, send the thing.
Well, this campaign is sayno.ie. It looks like sanyo.ie, but it's sayno.ie, and you could go to that website. It'd be info, I think, at sayno.ie is the email address. Well, go to the website. It's going to have some information on it for you. Sayno.ie. Thank you.